Good afternoon and welcome to the program. My name is Jerry Boyer and you're listening to American Entrepreneur Radio on WMNY. And as you know, if you're a regular listener to this show, that I have been making it a project to get American investors and entrepreneurs to begin to think of their range of possibilities for wealth creation to go beyond the United States of America and to begin to think of the whole world. Because as the United States of America seems to have gotten bored with this freedom thing that we're so well known for, much of the world has moved towards freedom. Some of the world that was very unfree has become almost as free as we are. Some nations are as free as we are. And a number of nations, believe it or not, have become more free than we are. According to the Economic Freedom of the World study, and we've had the authors of that study on this program, and the Index of Economic Freedom from the Heritage Foundation, America is either 8th or 9th or 10th, probably 11th from the top when it comes to economic freedom. We are no longer the freest nation in the world. And as a country that's no longer the freest nation in the world, that means that we are no longer the most viable investment environment. We are no longer the best place to do business for entrepreneurs. In helping us with this educational process, I've called upon Ron Manners, who is himself a successful entrepreneur in Western Australia, and who was also the founder of the Mankow Economic Freedom Foundation, to come here and talk to us about the state of freedom in his country and the state of freedom in his part of the world, because he's involved in an industry that involves a great deal of international business. He's in the mining industry, and Australia is a great exporter of mining resources. So he has to follow what's going on in the economic environment all over that part of the world. So, Ron Manners, welcome to American Entrepreneur Radio.
Welcome. I'm very happy to be here, Jerry, with you.
It's great to have you here. And you come highly recommended by our mutual friend Alex Chafwin from the Atlas Economic Freedom Foundation here in the United States. So tell me a little bit about your entrepreneurial background. Since most of the listeners to this show are entrepreneurs, what's your business? How did you get started in it? And what do you see?
I've had a long-term involvement in mining, prospecting and mining, and I've floated a few public companies, and we've gone on to one of our companies produced 1.25 million ounces of gold, and we paid 11 dividends. So I regard mining as a business, and it's probably one of the most creative businesses in the whole world, where you can go out into the field where there is absolutely nothing. Absolutely zero, and then with technology and geological skills, you can actually make a discovery. Then you can turn that into something of value, and by processing or by mining it and processing it and selling it, you create a lot of wealth for a lot of people, for everyone in the nation actually. And this is Western Australia, where I live, is about one third of the area of Australia, but we've only got 8% of the people. But that 8% of the people create 46% of Australia's export income. So you can see we have a different set of priorities. The other states where there's 96% of the population, they really 92% rather, they really are what you regard as your rust bucket states. So they depend very much on us for their livelihood. And there's quite a dichotomy here, and the mining industry is being blamed for creating a two-speed economy. We're blamed for creating high wages and high housing costs and things like that. Wouldn't you think that's a good thing rather than a bad thing? But we're blamed for that.
Well, it depends.
Other people that are hanging on are really pretty much our Greece, as the Greece is to Europe. You know, they're like an anchor that we're dragging. However, we're very generous about this, and we don't mind dragging them around, because we know that a healthy dog can always support a few fleas.
Well, as to the question of whether that's a bad thing, I suppose it depends on your value system. If your value system is growing the pie of economic growth, then of course there's always going to be people who grow it faster, and that's your two-speed economy. If your value system is equality of economic distribution or equality of outcome, if your value system is everybody being at the same level together, even if that level is dropping, then I suppose a two-speed economy would be a bad thing. But of course, they ought to make explicit that that's the bargain that they're proposing, a lower standard of living for everybody in exchange for sharing the misery. But the situation in the United States is very much like the situation in Australia, where half of the country is in the cart being pulled and half of the country is outside of the cart. Really, less than half is outside of the cart pulling them along. Tell me a little bit about, it's interesting, you brought up the issue of mining. Is there room for innovation and entrepreneurship in your industry? In other words, is it just if you own the mine, then you're the owner, or are there still large productivity gains to be had, technological gains to be had? Is this an industry that's mature and past its innovation point, or is there still innovation going on in the mining industry?
We depend on innovation. We depend on technology. The our continent is a very, very old continent geologically, and I didn't realize until I looked at Canada and other countries, there are virtually no rocks sticking out of the ground here. You can't read the geology by looking at the outcropping rocks, because there's not a lot of outcrop. We're a large proportion of the area is covered by wind-blown sand up to 60 meters in depth, and that requires all sorts of electronic and geophysical devices to see through that sand before you can find the targets in which to drill. So we're all technologists. We don't walk around looking for nuggets anymore. They're well down, well beneath the Earth's surface. But the challenge is there, and I think we're up to it as an industry, and the industry is doing very well. Although I must say there are a few little problems like land access that is driving a few people nuts, and this is why any country you go, South America, any of the 52 African countries, or any of the former Soviet Union countries, you cannot go to an airport without seeing Australian geologists, because they are everywhere. And when the land access problems became a little bit difficult started about 1996, we exercised our freedoms, and a lot of us just got on planes and took investment dollars with us. And that's why we've been so successful at finding ore deposits in other parts of the world.
So you helped make other countries wealthy when your country became hostile to wealth creation.
Oh, sure. This is the wonderful thing about the entrepreneurial spirit. If you're not welcome, you go somewhere else. You just take it with you. I remember an old friend of mine who's no longer alive. His name is Harry Brown. He was an investment guru and a bit of a gold bug. I think back about 1982, Harry, we laughingly said, he said, the number of people that ask him the question of which is the best country in the world, he said, well, it's a crazy question. He said, there are three different questions. Which is the best country in which to live? Which is the best country in which to work? And which country is the best in which to invest? And he said, only for brief seconds in history has it ever been the same country that is the answer to all of those three questions. So he said, if you're lucky, you actually work with your mind rather than work with your hands. So if you were a dentist, for instance, you must work where you live.
Yes.
Because you're relying on your set of hands very at close range. But with a lot of professions, you can actually choose the best country in which to live, and you can work with your brains, certainly with the connected community as we have with all the computerization. You can be working in another country, and then the surplus that you develop, you can invest in yet another country. So you can get the very best of those three countries, and you can enjoy the very best of those three countries, but they certainly won't be the same country.
Well, and Americans have developed mental habit of not separating those questions and thinking automatically the United States is the best country to live in, the best country to work in, and the best country to invest in. And one of the things I'm trying to do is to separate those questions and to say to investors, your capital has to be mobile, because countries are always phasing in and out of freedom. And in anticipating that, the countries that have a great deal of economic freedom are far superior investment opportunities, investment environments, to countries that are sort of moving away from freedom. And that they perform, the countries that are moving towards freedom actually perform much better. I've done a lot of analysis on this, looking at stock market returns and how they correlate with economic freedom. Excuse me. And the correlations are uncanny. So what would be helpful to me is to get a sense from you about what you're seeing. First of all, whether you agree with that idea that freedom makes for a good investment environment. And secondly, what you're seeing in your world travels, your own country. You're involved with the Lion Rock Institute in Hong Kong and a lot of the free market institutes, you know, in Southeast Asia. What you're seeing, so that can be a guide to people who are listening now who are saying, you know, maybe it's time that I don't have all my money in the United States. Maybe I move it to someplace that's freer. So what I'd like to do is take a quick break and then come back, and then you take on those questions. How's that with you, Ron?
Sure, that's fine.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment. And welcome back to the program. My name is Jerry Boyer, and you're still listening to American Entrepreneur Radio on WMNY. But of course, as you know, just because you're an American entrepreneur and or investor doesn't mean you only have to entrepreneur and invest in America. And increasingly, as America has had its dangerous flirtation with socialism, and yes, I do mean socialism. I know that that's one of those flinch words. Well, that's a shame. Because it seems to me that the direction of the country over the past couple of years has been towards maybe a mild form of socialism. I mean, it's not Lenin and Stalin, of course, but it is government control of the means of production of the commanding heights. And that has been very hostile to wealth creation. And you know, the markets have shown that. Stock markets, bond markets, currency market especially, has shown that hostility to growth. So I've asked Ron Manners, who is a very interesting fellow. He's a very successful mining entrepreneur in Western Australia. He's lived a varied life, which you can read about in his book, Heroic Misadventures, which you can get at www.heroicmisadventures.com. And he's also the founder of his own economic freedom think tank, the Menkel Foundation, which you can also look up online. And Ron is somebody who follows the level of freedom not just in his country, but he spends a lot of time in that part of the world, and even here in the United States from time to time. Okay, so Ron, as you're looking at your own country situation, you're looking at Hong Kong. I know that you were just in Hong Kong recently. I'm sure you keep an eye on Thailand, Singapore, Taiwan, probably Japan for that matter. What are you seeing in terms of economic freedom and investment environment?
Well, I see opportunities. I see opportunities like I've never seen before, because whilst we've got a collection of autocratic governments in many parts of the world, they've got the ability to use your money against you, and they can they've got all the time in the world, but they haven't got the nimbleness of the those with the entrepreneurial spirit who can stay one jump ahead. The ability now, and this reminds me back when I started writing letters to a guy who became my favorite economist, F.A. Hayek. I began writing letters to him because he wrote a little book called The Denationalization of Money, where he was promoting the ideas of having a choice of currency. So if we suspected the currency of our country was not legitimate and not a sound currency, we could then elect to use another currency. Now, that was highly illegal at that time in the mid-70s. It was highly illegal. And now we really have got the choice of currencies, because you can put currencies in your suitcase, you can take one currency here and take currency there, and you can elect to do these things. But what's happened since he was talking to me and since he wrote that book in the 70s was that almost all currencies, all paper currencies, are tending toward the worthless. I know it was just fairly recently that the Swiss franc has been devalued and it's not pegged against any real values, so that and this is causing the extremely high interest in gold. There's another currency in gold certificates. I know the Perth Mint, who's backed by the state government of Western Australia, are having a record turnover producing these gold certificates, which is a very convenient way for people to hold gold, which is then held by them. But they hold gold as a hedge against further devaluation of the currency. I know you guys in the States, you've lost 95% of the purchasing value of your dollars since, I think, in 1914.
Yes.
And it's just rapidly going out the door. But unfortunately, all the paper currencies are. But you have the choice. You have the choice of being able to hold real assets too, which in place of any paper money. So that's a lot of the mining entrepreneurs I know and I'm involved with have got a portfolio of gold properties in which they're exploring and developing mines in various countries. So there's an escape route. If a country nationalizes their ground or the mine, they can just put their guys on a plane. Some of their equipment is portable, and they're off to better fields. So
yeah,
there's a tremendous choice, and it's the same when you're investing. The wonderful electronic way that the stock exchanges of the world are all accessible to absolutely anyone, and with your portfolio management, just a bit of simple free software, the Google Finance Portfolio, for instance, it can access any stock market and give you a running total of your share portfolio 24 hours a day, anywhere
yes.
at all.
So yes.
You can pick and choose. You can have three or four gold stocks. You might buy an Australian gold stock, and you find that all their production is coming out of Thailand. In the case of, well, I won't mention company names, but they're Australian companies registered in Australia, listed on the Australian stock market, but their mines are elsewhere. And you can go to Hong Kong and you find there's listed companies up there, again, with mines in other countries. So the choices before us is amazing. We can choose the best, what we regard as the most reliable stock exchange for the
yes.
security side of things. And then we can choose the companies that we like with the management. And then we can follow their portfolios where they have their assets.
Ron, that raises an interesting question. As I've talked to people about the idea of investing where there's the most freedom, one of the arguments I get in response is, well, wait a minute, just because there's a lot of freedom in, you know, let's say Hong Kong, just because there's a lot of freedom in Hong Kong, well, the companies in Hong Kong are doing business all around the world. So don't you have to look at the level of freedom, mainly the level of freedom in the countries that they're operating, or does it matter to the domicile country? Does it matter if you're domiciled in a country that's freer? For example, I mean, you're fighting for more freedom in Australia, so your tendency is going to be to say, well, Australia is not as free as it should be, but it's a lot freer than it was 20 years ago.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So there was a movement towards freedom, and that's made Australia a more, a more attractive investment environment and a rival now, I think, to the United States, where 20 years ago it wasn't. But someone would say, well, what does it matter if Australia is free? Because those Australian mining companies are doing most of their work in Thailand. So what would you say to that? Does the domicile of the company matter, even if a lot of the operations are overseas?
I think it's like having a balanced portfolio. In the companies themselves are very nimble.
Hmm.
They're able to, if there was a discovery in a XYZ company in Africa, You would find in a very short time there would be a whole, there would be teams of Australians descend on that place and take a major position. And we'd be competing with the Canadians in particular, because they've had to be nimble for many years. They've had the same land access problems in Canada as Australia has had. And they don't seem to go away. They're traditional landholders, and you know these are unfortunately the legislation that created the land problems never really gave proper title to the traditional landowners.
I see.
It simply gave them a license to get in the way.
Ah.
So that's all they have to deal with. They're not able to deal with or sell or lease the land that they own. They can just sell the price of them getting out of the way and permitting you to explore. It's a very clumsy way of saying it, but unfortunately they were never given, the land title is called a native title.
I see.
Got any title.
It seems to me in the mining industry and in energy, which is closely related to mining, that having property rights that go beneath the surface of the ground are an extremely important incentive for production. And this is something I've written about for Forbes and some of the other columns, that in countries where you own what's on your property, not just on the surface, but what's underneath, you have more incentive to discover it. You have more incentive to allow people to explore because you have an advantage in that. But I want to go back to this nimbleness point that you made. I think what I'm hearing you say is if a country has a heritage of freedom and a culture of innovation, then they're going to be more nimble. So that they'll be able to go around and pursue opportunities around the world, even if the growth in that particular country may not be the highest. A country domiciled in a free nation is able to diversify internationally more effectively than a country that's domiciled in an unfree nation where your board of directors is not just your owners, but the unions and the academics and, you know, kind of the European model. That nimbleness is partly a function of the level of freedom of the country you're domiciled in. Is that right?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay. Let's take a quick look at the rest of the world. And as I look here, we're running out of time for this segment. I hate to put you on the spot, but would you be willing to do another 12-minute segment with me?
Sure.
Okay. Let's look at Southeast Asia. And maybe if we have some time left over, I just want to hear what a gold miner is thinking about what's going on in the gold side of things. So let's take a quick break, and we'll come back in just a moment, and we'll talk more with Ron Manners. Ron Manners has a book, basically a memoir of a storied life, the memoir is entitled Heroic Misadventures, and you can get that online. And he's also the founder of the Mankow Foundation, which is devoted to the idea of promoting economic freedom in his part of the world, which is Western Australia. But he's involved with other freedom-promoting organizations across that whole part of the whole eastern, southeastern time zone. He's a good resource for us. We'll be right back. And welcome back to American Entrepreneur Radio. I'm your host, Jerry Boyer. You're listening on WMNY. And we're talking with Ron Manners from Western Australia, from Perth, who's talking to us about what he sees in his part of the world. Ron, what are you seeing in what they call the tiger economies or the Asian, Pacific Rim economies? You were just in Hong Kong. I know you're involved with a think tank there called the Lion Rock Institute. You also keep your eye on other countries, Singapore, for example, Taiwan. What are you seeing in terms of the movement towards or away from freedom in that part of the world?
I think the movement is toward freedom because it's very hard to restrict freedoms anymore. I mean, they might try, but uh, the uh, the autocratic governments have lost their major advantage, and that was the advantage of knowledge that the Rothschilds and the one world government used to have, because they had the news. They had the news, they had the information weeks and sometimes months before the general populace. But with the internet and the ability for everyone at street level gets the news sometimes before the power brokers get the news.
Huh.
And so the people trying to control other people, the people that try to subject others to the iron hand, can't do it anymore. And we've seen these quite interesting Arab Spring revolts, and I've spoken to so many people from them, and I want to distinguish the Arab Spring revolts as quite a separate animal to the Occupy Wall Street, and I've seen the Occupy Hong Kong and the Occupy anywhere else. I've got the Occupy Sydney groups. These are absolutely nothing to do with the nobility and the sense of purpose behind the people that have brought down dictators in these Arab Spring countries.
Hmm. I think, as I recall, the Rothschilds used carrier pigeons, didn't they? Didn't they have someone watching the Battle of Waterloo?
They were way ahead. They knew when wars had finished. They knew who the winners were. They knew they could, as we say, punt or gamble on the stock markets and take various positions. Now, that's all. The average guy, you and I sitting here at our computer, we see it flashed on the screen. We get it. We get it at the same time as CNN or the other networks. So we're one jump ahead.
And I wonder whether we don't have another advantage, which is that elite opinion. If you go to an elite university, say an Ivy League university in the United States, you're inculcated with Keynesianism. Which is an inferior economic system. So they get data, they get information, and then they put it through their Keynesian models, which are distorted, and come to, you know, distorted conclusions about the economy. Whereas people just, you're sitting at home, I mean, here I am, I'm outside Pittsburgh, my family and I, we read Hayek and von Mises and Adam Smith and Milton Friedman and the rest of them, and we get the same data as the top guys in Wall Street, but we have a better model because we don't have the disadvantage of going to the top schools where Keynesianism dominates. And so in some ways, I think we can even do better with the data.
We are tuned for survival.
Ah. We're tuned, and survival is a powerful motivational tool.
Yep.
Even more than domination. If someone's fighting to dominate me, he might have an incentive to dominate me because he likes it, but I have a greater incentive to not be dominated because I can't live without freedom.
That's it. Yep.
Okay, so let's look at them. Hong Kong, freest country in the world by most measures. Do you agree with that?
That certainly has been the case for at least 16 years, for as long as that Fraser Institute publication that comes out with the other think tanks, and by their criteria. But again, it's theoretically it's a communist dictatorship,
right?
But it's very hard to believe that when you're wandering the streets of Hong Kong and the ability to do things. I know that the Lion Rock Institute, when they launched that Freedom of the World book, they had the Secretary General, the virtual the President of Hong Kong, you know, Donald Tsang, he was the guest speaker, and they actually congratulated him on the night for all the things that he hadn't done.
Well, when it comes to government, the things you don't do are far more valuable than the things you do.
Absolutely, and he got the message, and he took it in very good spirit.
Hong Kong is the freest country in the world, ruled over by one of the least free countries in the world.
Yep.
So there's a danger there.
And it certainly would adversely affect Beijing's investment in Hong Kong by destroying the very model that works.
I see. So that's a protection against the danger of domination from China, that they need that economic growth coming out of Hong Kong. Now, what about Singapore? You don't have that situation. It's an independent city-state and nearly as free as Hong Kong. What's your take on Singapore?
Singapore's quite different. It's not the laid-back, laissez-faire. It's a very regimented city, and so many people say Hong Kong and Singapore almost in the same breath, as though they are the same beast. The background is British. The English is a widely spoken language in both. However, Hong Kong is the freewheeling economy, absolutely freewheeling. Singapore is very regimented, but I must say they're highly competitive, and they are promoting their Singapore model. They are approaching many companies, Australian companies, that they're saying you should base your head office here, because whatever you do, your staff, your personnel can be based here, and they cannot pay more than 10% tax. Whatever they do, they cannot possibly pay more than 10% tax.
That's a powerful inducement. Are Australian companies biting on that? Are they beginning to be interested in that?
There are a lot of people basing their operations, and they have their teams there, and they fly in and out of Australia, because a lot of the operations are in the north of Australia, which means Singapore is actually
closer.
As close as Sydney is.
I see. What about Taiwan? What do you think about the Taiwan model and the situation there?
Taiwan is, again, extremely competitive, but because it's not resource rich, it doesn't have the same magnetic attractions. If you're talking about Singapore, you're right on the boundary of Thailand and all of Vietnam and a lot of very mineralized rich countries, but Taiwan is a different thing. It's a great place to live, a great place to do business with, but it's not resource based.
I see. Well, is that in some ways an advantage? There's this idea of the commodity curse, that countries that have a lot of commodities tend to move away from entrepreneurship and freedom because they're highly dependent on the commodity. What do you think about that theory of the commodity curse?
It can happen. We see signs of it happening in Australia. We've seen it happen where people become totally dependent on it. You can get some of these Arab countries where they're totally dependent on oil, and the oil runs out. They haven't developed other skills, and they depend very much on technology and the technologists from other countries.
Right.
Now, there's a balance, but I still think we all should focus clearly on our own competitive advantage. And
yes,
in those Arab countries, their competitive advantage is that they produce oil, and that's in great demand.
Now, you mentioned Thailand. Thailand is less free than the other countries we've been discussing, but, still, it's been a high-growth economy. They had a recent election, and they expected civil unrest, and they didn't get much civil unrest after that election. What's your take on Thailand?
Well, Thailand, all those Asian tigers, as they're called, they really have come out of this GFC. Do you call it the GFC, the global financial crisis? They've all come out of this fairly well, as Australia has, and the reason for that is that it's not because we're smart, or it's not because we're smarter than anyone else. I think if I can put Turkey in the same category, I've just come back from 3 weeks in Turkey, put them in the same category. Turkey had a financial crisis of its own and a banking crisis about 2002. And that caused them to clean up their banking act, to clean up the finances, to get rid of all these unserviceable loans.
Yes.
And they took their haircuts. The Asian countries, and we were right in the middle of that from Australia in 1997, we had the Asian financial crisis, and that was a real king hit. That knocked our banking. Even we had a banking crisis just a few years before that. We had all sorts of banking inquiries, and they cleaned up. Our banks and the Asian banks and the Turkish banks had not had enough time to let our banks become, if you might say, untidy again. And we were in relatively good shape because we couldn't, there weren't things hanging and hidden in cupboards. But I think you guys in America, and particularly Europe, had not had a recent banking crisis, and you were as untidy as all hell.
Well, that's true. The Asian countries learned from the Asian contagion of 1997, 1998, 1999, cleaned up their act, cut their spending, dealt with their deficit problem, dealt with opacity problems, and shored up their banking system, and we didn't. So that's meant that the East has done better during this crisis than the West has. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Ron Manners, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been a great pleasure getting your insights here on The American Entrepreneur.
My great pleasure.